Lecture 16, Wild and Coward, Part 2, The Ends of New Comedy.
Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest and Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit both exemplify new ways of handling new comedy. In my previous lecture, I sketched out some of the ways in which these plays handle the new comedy plot of marriage, either turning it into a parody of marriage or into a motif of remarriage. In this lecture and the next, I want to look at Blithe Spirit and The Importance of Being Earnest in detail in order to call attention to the ways in which they work with and transform the details of the comic tradition as we have seen it. I call this lecture The Ends of New Comedy, and I mean that in two ways. Wild and Coward represent, to some degree, the goals or the end points of new comedy. In other words, what is the goal of new comedy? Its goal is to create a kind of healthy laughter, a world in which ridiculous things seem merely risible, a world in which the group experience of laughter brings that group together into a whole and healthy social body. But I also think that Wilde and Coward represent the ends of new comedy because, in some sense, new comedy ends with them. There is, as I suggested, and as I will illustrate in greater detail, a growing gap between the relationships portrayed on the stage and the relationships that members of the audience would have in real life. The world of masters and servants, for example, that both plays represent, no longer corresponds to the world of masters and servants in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And if we had any question about the role of dramatic writing or of comic performance as holding a mirror up to nature, that question is not answered, but rather is simply dispelled out of hand, as Coward makes the subject of his play the afterlife, and as the true dilemma deals not with living people, but with dead shades. Central to the new comedy tradition, as I have detailed it, is the relationship of plot and subplot. Throughout the new comedies, elaborate subplots, often centered on minor or stereotypically represented characters, work in order to reflect, comically or baroquely even, on the major plot problems of their plays, especially the themes of marriage, of parental guidance, of class and impersonation. In other words, the subplots very often replay the stories of the major plots, except they do so in broader or sillier or ridiculous ways. So one could argue that the realm of the subplot is the ridiculous, whereas the realm of the main plot is the risible. These subplots, too, very often dramatize the intersection between old comedy farce and new comedy marriage. Subplot characters are very often old comedy types. That is, they're caricatures of social or personal kinds of figures. They may have particular historical or topical relevance to the play's original audience, a relevance that may be lost to modern viewers. Wilde and Coward illustrate what I believe to be the move in 20th century comedy to the progressive elimination of the subplot as a dramatic device. Let me give you an example. In The Importance of Being Earnest, we have the Prism-Chasuble subplot, Miss Prism the governess, and the Reverend Dr. Chasuble the local canon, seem at first glance to be obvious characters in a Baroque subplot whose actions will reflect parodically on the actions of the main plot characters. We expect there to be a romance. We expect there to be a marriage. What Wilde does, however, is he takes his minor subplot character, Miss Prism, who should normally be simply an ornament to the play, and he, in fact, makes her central to the resolution of the plot as a whole. Towards the close of the play, as Jack and Chasuble are talking with Lady Bracknell, Dr. Chasuble says, "Miss Prism has been waiting for me in the vestry." And Lady Bracknell stands up, startled. "Miss Prism? Did I hear you mention a Miss Prism?" Chasuble, "Yes, Lady Bracknell. I'm on my way to join her. Pray allow me to detain you for a moment. This matter may prove to be one of vital importance to Lord Bracknell and myself. Is this Miss Prism a female of repellent aspect remotely connected with education?" "No." Chasuble, "She is the most cultivated of ladies and the very picture of respectability." "It is obviously the same person. May I ask what position she holds in your household?" Chasuble, "I am celibate, madam." Jack, "Miss Prism, Lady Bracknell, has been for the last 3 years Miss Cardew's, that is Cecily's, esteemed governess and valued companion." Lady Bracknell, "In spite of what I hear of her, I must see her at once. Let her be sent for." Miss Prism shows up. She catches sight of Lady Bracknell. She grows pale. She anxiously looks around as if desirous to escape. Lady Bracknell, and here the stage direction reads in a severe judicial voice, "Prism! Come here! Prism! Prism! Where is that baby?" Now, what had happened was that 28 years ago, Miss Prism had left Lord Bracknell's house in charge of a perambulator that contained a male child, and she never returned. A few weeks later, however, what was returned was the perambulator, and as Lady Bracknell describes it, "It contained the manuscript of a 3-volume novel of more than usually revolting sentimentality. But the baby was not there." "Prism! Where is that baby?" Well, of course, as we will find out, that baby is none other than Jack. But the high point of this scene lies in bringing Prism into the plot line, that the subplot becomes absorbed into the main plot. And I think Miss Prism's name must be transparent here. Much as the names of the comic characters of The Rivals gave us insight into their personality, their stereotypical representation, and their dramatic function, so Miss Prism becomes the prism through which the seemingly white light of the play becomes fragmented into a spectrum of wild colors, that we see now this resolution moving through the image of Miss Prism herself. She is the prism through which we must understand the play. Now, if Wilde collapses subplot into plot, Coward, in Blithe Spirit, merely raises the specter of the subplot, but only to dismiss it. In Blithe Spirit, there is virtually no subplot at all. Minor characters such as the Bradmans are introduced, but they seem to be dispensed with. And Edith, for example, much like Miss Prism, who could become a subplot caricature, similarly becomes central to the resolution of the story. For at the end of Blythe's Spirit, it is Edith who comes in the trance, singing in her Cockney servant's voice, "I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true, always." I'll spend more time on the camp quality of this ventriloquism of the song, but suffice it to say that Edith's crazed entrance, much like Prism's revelation at the end of The Importance of Being Earnest, show us how the traditional subplotting of new comedy gets transformed in Wild and Coward as key features of the main plot line. Like all great new comedies, The Importance of Being Earnest and Blythe's Spirit rely on relationships between masters and servants. We've seen this from the very beginning in the old comedy tradition exemplified by Aristophanes and in the new comedy tradition exemplified by Plautus. And in the new comedy tradition, it is the servant who seems to take over, who becomes the figure, perhaps for the playwright, or who becomes the truly manipulative master of the situation. In Wilde, this relationship between master and servant is similarly inverted, where you have the servants in effect drink champagne, and where the servants are complicit participants in the theater of impersonation run by their masters. Let's look at the very opening of The Importance of Being Earnest, the scene between Algernon and his servant, Lane. Algernon is playing the piano, and he opens the play by saying, "Did you hear what I was playing, Lane?" Lane: "I didn't think it polite to listen, sir." Algernon: "I'm sorry for that, for your sake. I don't play accurately. Anyone can play accurately, but I play with wonderful expression. As far as the piano is concerned, sentiment is my forte. I keep science for life." Lane: "Yes, sir." Algernon: "And speaking of the science of life, have you got the cucumber sandwiches for Lady Bracknell?" Lane: "Yes, sir." And he hands them over on a salver. Algernon inspects them, takes two, and sits down. "Oh, by the way, Lane, I see from your book that on Thursday night, when Lord Shoreman and Mr. Worthing were dining with me, 8 bottles of champagne are entered as having been consumed."
"Yes, sir. 8 bottles and a pint."
Algernon: "Why is it that at a bachelor's establishment the servants invariably drink the champagne? I ask merely for information."
Lane: "I attribute it to the superior quality of the wine, sir. I have often observed that in married households the champagne is rarely of a first-rate brand."
Algernon: "Good heavens, is marriage so demoralizing as that?"
Lane: "I believe it is a very pleasant state, sir. I have had very little experience of it myself up to the present. I have only been married once. That was in consequence of a misunderstanding between myself and a young person."
Algernon: "I don't know that I am much interested in your family life, Lane."
Lane: "No, sir, it is not a very interesting subject. I never think of it myself."
Algernon: "Very natural, I'm sure. That will do, Lane. Thank you."
"Thank you, sir."
Well, this exchange between Algernon and Lane shows us how Lane is in many ways a willing participant in the banter, in the roles of impersonation, in the livelihood of the master. And I believe, in fact, and one might offer this just as a historical aside, I believe that the relationship between Algernon and Lane is something of the seed behind the relationship of Jeeves and Worcester in the Woodhouse novels. There is the sense that Lane is somehow more knowing than Algernon, and that Algernon and Lane represent a master-servant relationship which is fictive, which is performative, which is wholly unreal. And if it seems to me there was any doubt of the unreal performative nature of this exchange, it lies in the stage direction that I deliberately did not read. For when Algernon says, "I don't know that I am much interested in your family life, Lane," the stage direction tells us that Algernon should say it languidly. Algernon has become the male version of Lydia Languish. And the relationship between Algernon and Lane looks back to the relationship between Lydia and her servant in The Rivals. I would suggest that this is something of a benchmark now in the relationships of masters and servants in new comedy. This relationship continues in the scene when Lady Bracknell enters and the cucumber sandwiches are served. Now, of course, you'll remember that Algernon has eaten all of them. And Algernon picks up the empty plate and he's about to give them to Lady Bracknell. "Good heavens, Lane, why are there no cucumber sandwiches? I ordered them especially." Lane: "There were no cucumbers in the market this morning, sir. I went down twice." Algernon: "No cucumbers?" Lane: "No, sir. Not even for ready money." Algernon: "That will do, Lane. Thank you." Lane: "Thank you, sir." Well, here, of course, what's Lane going to do? Expose his master for having eaten all the cucumber sandwiches? Not likely. They perform a little skit, a little imaginative play before the audience of Lady Bracknell. And it seems to me that this notion of master-servant relationships has now become highly theatricalized. In other words, what Wilde is showing us is that the real relationships of master and servant are theatrical relationships. Their performances, their play, they do not represent social reality. Lady Bracknell similarly invokes the tone of the master in the way in which she effectively deals with everybody as if they were a servant. Look at the way that Lady Bracknell speaks to Gwendolyn. I'm just going to read a very brief passage. Lady Bracknell speaks to Gwendolyn: "Come here! Sit down! Sit down immediately! Hesitation of any kind is a sign of mental decay in the young and of physical weakness in the old." This bossiness is not simply the articulation of a bossy persona, but it is the, as it were, appropriation of the role of the boss. I want to suggest that Lady Bracknell, much like Mrs. Malaprop, is a construction, is a highly wrought, theatricalized figure. And at any moment, we may see through the cracks and fissures of that character and find the emptiness behind it. So, much as Mrs. Malaprop is constantly using what she called her oracular tongue to create a facade of linguistic ability, Lady Bracknell is using her own oracular quality to create a facade of social invulnerability. Masters and servants, then, in Wilde, play out these performances that, as I suggested, estrange themselves from everyday social life. In Coward, as we know, the servant is, as it were, the deus ex machina, the figure who really makes the plot resolve. Edith is the key to the resolution. And as I mentioned, her reentry at the play's close makes possible the dismissal of the shades of the two wives. But more to the point, the world of Blithe Spirit is a world in which servants fail. Edith really is a lousy maid, and the cook is probably not very good. She, in fact, quits in Act 2, Scene 2. And here's what Mrs. Bradiman says: "Servants are awful, aren't they? Not a shred of gratitude. At the first sign of trouble, they run out on you, like rats leaving a sinking ship." Well, what rats are leaving what sinking ships in 1941? This is a play which, while performed during the Second World War, seems to operate in a curious fantasy land of the Howardian imagination. For by the 1940s, servant culture has changed dramatically. And one of the themes of Blythe's spirit, it seems to me, is the way in which certain devices of the theater and of the genre of new comedy just no longer correspond to the social realities of everyday life. There's a war going on, and yet you can have servants who are running out of you like rats leaving a sinking ship. The real war is the war of shades, not the war of ships in Coward's 1941 Blithe Spirit. This transformation of the servant role corresponds as well to Wilde and Coward's transformation of another key part of the new comedy tradition, the double role. Comedy has always been the story of doubles, of mistaken identity, of impersonation, of twins, of sibling rivalry, of two men in love with the same woman. This is the stuff of comic plotting. Now, in Wilde, doubling is the key to the play. It makes the theme work and the plot resolve. You have Algernon and Jack, Gwendolyn and Cecily, Jack as Ernest, Algernon and his Bunbury, Algernon pretending to be Jack's brother, Algernon and Jack really turn out to be brothers. This is a wonderful twist on the new comedy device of the twins or the brothers or of the person pretending to be his or her own twin. And you'll remember here Millais Gloriosus and the girl who pretends to be her own identical twin. These moments of twinning and doubling in the new comedy tradition, as I suggested, were always occasions for reflections on the art of acting itself, playing somebody else. The doubling of a role in the Shakespearean theater, I suggested, made possible the idea that I mooted in my lecture on The Taming of the Shrew, that the young boy actor who played the page masquerading as Christopher Sly's wife in the introduction to that play would also play Kate in the body of the play, and that the words of obedience spoken mockingly at one point and apparently sincerely at the other point would both be ironized, would both be seen as performances by a knowing audience of Shakespeare's time. Now, in Coward, this act of doubling is effectively inverted. For instead of two men in love with the same woman, we have two wives for the same man. But the plot device of having the second wife also creates a new twist. For the first wife is dead, and now, with the second wife dead, we have another set of doubles. That is, the living and the dead, the physical and the protoplasmic, the real and the shade. What does it mean to cross over to the other side? Are we the same over there as over here? What Wilde, and I think more explicitly Coward, do is they use the idea of doubling as the essence of what Susan Sontag calls the camp sensibility, the recognition that there is always another seemingly similar version of the same thing or person out there. One living, one dead. One city, one country. One straight, one not. One sincere, one ironic. The dead in Blythe's spirit, I suggest, are the ironic, campy, bitchy, witty, acerbic versions of the, for lack of a better term, straight women who acted as Charles's wives when they were alive. If the other world is a world of campy sensibility, how is it possible to sustain a new comedy marriage plot when the sub-theme of blithe spirit is not procreative marriage at all. I concluded my previous lecture by calling attention to the way in which Coward sublimates the sexual impulse through the symbol of the billiard cue. And in Wilde and Coward, parent and child relationships are either wildly distorted or they are completely eliminated. In Wilde, we only have one real living parent. That's Lady Bracknell, because she's Gwendolyn's mother. But what we do have a great deal of are surrogate parents, what I would call play parents. Jack is Cecily's guardian, and he's like a play father or a play parent to her. Lady Bracknell is Algernon's aunt, and she functions as a kind of play mother to him. And you will remember, of course, that Jack has lost both of his parents. As Lady Bracknell puts it in a wonderful aphorism, "To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness." Jack has been all too careless in losing both his parents. But I suggest that it is not a question of carelessness nor a question of misfortune, but a question of deliberate suppression. That is, the traditional parent-child relationships and their procreative function really have no role in the campy parodies of Wilde or Coward. Now, in Coward, there are no parent-child relationships. There may be highly abstracted or surrogate ones. For example, Edith, the maid, is genuinely childlike. And Madame Arcati is like one's dotty aunt. She may stand in that genealogy of older female comic figures running from, let's say, Madame Pernell in Tartuffe through Mrs. Malaprop and Lady Bracknell. In fact, in the opening scene of the play Blithe Spirit, there is that moment when we see, in fact, that the servant had been dismissed for the following reason. Charles, "What do you suppose induced Agnes to leave us and go and get married?" Ruth, "The reason was becoming increasingly obvious, dear." Charles, "Yes, but in these days nobody thinks anything of that sort of thing. She could have popped into the cottage hospital, had it, and popped out again." Ruth, "Her social life would have been seriously undermined." Charles, "We must keep Edith in the house more." We must keep Edith in the house more, meaning that sexual activity, the engine of new comedy, must be kept under wraps. So what you get in Blithe Spirit is surrogate sexuality. And the figure, it seems to me, of sublime surrogate sexuality is Madame Arcati. Madame Arcati talks about bicycling in the following way. "It stimulates me. I was getting far too sedentary in London. That horrid little flat with the dim lights had to be dim, you know. The clients expect it." And Mrs. Bradman says of bicycle riding, "I must say I find bicycling very exhausting, Madame Arcati. Steady rhythm, that's what counts. Once you get the knack of it, you need never look back. On your way and get you go." Madame Arcati talks about bicycle riding, and then she talks about her first spiritual experience. "I was quite tiny. My mother was a medium before me, you know, and I had every opportunity of starting on the ground floor. I had my first trance when I was 4 years old and my first protoplasmic manifestation when I was 5 and a half. What an exciting day that was. I shall never forget it. Of course, the manifestation was quite small and a very short duration, but for a child of my tender years, it was most gratifying." And then, of course, towards the end of the play, this wonderful moment when the ghost of Elvira blows in Madame Arcati's ear, and Madame Arcati, "Yes, yes, again, again." Elvira blows again and says, "How's that?" Madame Arcati, clasping and unclasping her hands in a frenzy of excitement, "This is first rate, really first rate, absolutely stunning." In a world of camp sensibility, sexuality can only be sublimated or surrogated. And I suggest, in closing, that Madame Arcati is, in fact, the most truly sexual figure of this play. And yet, it is not sexuality with another, but sexuality with a self, a kind of auto-sexuality, where riding the bicycle, having the protoplasmic experience, or commuting with the spirits leads one into a wild performance of the auto-erotic. As we will see in subsequent lectures, this autoerotic leads to the performative quality of Wilde and Coward and gives us their camp take on the ends of New Comedy.